Welcome to episode 73 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast, where we talk about everything related to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Dermot.
How are you doing tonight, Dermot?
Really well.
Great. Are you ready to talk about number two?
Yeah.
We would like to add at the top of the show here, I suppose you could call it a content warning for little ears. We're going to be talking about some stuff that you might not want your kids listening to.
Oh, dear.
So be warned. We won't say anything more obscene than what you would find within the text of Ulysses.
So if any here offended be, then blame the author. Blame not me.
We are a blog as well as a podcast. So if you want more info about Joyce's Ulysses, go check out our blog at
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Yeah, I am hard at work on a post that will definitively answer the question, who is the man in the Macintosh? It won't actually do that, but we recently posted a blog post about another mysterious Ulysses figure, Millie Bloom. So if you want to know why Millie Bloom is really a key character in Ulysses, you should go check that out. And Dermot here is the artist of the podcast, and he has done some fantastic artwork for this episode, and I'd like you to tell our listeners a little bit about it.
Yeah, the subject of this was the Freudian anal stage of Leopold Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And Kelly asked me if I, as long as I didn't do a picture of, you know, Bloom on the toilet. So I thought, I will do a picture of Bloom on the toilet, mm-hmm. but it'll be baby Bloom. And he's actually in the literal anal stage because he's a baby on the potty. And I really like this. I was really pleased with the way this came out. It's actually kind of cute. And he's reading Titbits magazine.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a little bowler. He's got his little hat on. Mm-hmm. Remember what that kind of hat's called. Yeah, and he's got his mustache as well. So we can see it's baby Bloom.
Well, if somebody wants to check out your very fine and high quality artwork, how can they do that?
Again, bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Go there and check it out, and you can find the show notes for this episode there as well. Any reading we reference in this episode, you can find a link to it there. A few shout-outs before we jump into the text today. First of all, thanks to all who donated. I think everybody who donated in the last fortnight would like to remain anonymous, so thank you to you bashful folks. We really appreciate it. And if someone out there listening would like to give us money to hear us talk about the anal stage, where might they do that?
Again, bloomsandbarnacles.com. Top right of the page, we have a tip jar.
Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to keep up with us from month to month, you can also, at our website,
subscribe to our newsletter. This is what they call a call to action.
I actually just wanted you to say our website.
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Thanks for throwing some ad lingo in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can subscribe to our newsletter. It's totally free. It'll come to your email box. Yep, your email box once a month at the top of the month. And you don't have to worry about Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey tracking your activity on social media, though we are also very easy to find on both Twitter and Facebook. And in our newsletter, you can participate in our question of the month, which is this month, who is the man in the Macintosh? I know we're talking about Calypso on the podcast, but in the blog form of Blooms and Barnacles, we are talking about Hades. And I have already very bombastically claimed I will definitively answer this question without an answer. But I would like to know your answers. And if you send us an entertaining or illuminating answer, we will read it out on an upcoming episode of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. So send those our way, either via email or on one of our social media accounts. All right, well, with that, shall we look at the very end of Calypso, episode 4 of Ulysses? So today, Dermot, you're going to finish your fourth full episode of Ulysses.
Okay.
If anyone's reading along at home, this text is from pages 67 through 70, in my copy of Ulysses, which is the 1990 Vintage International Edition. And this is a section of Ulysses that, while Ezra Pound was proofreading it for publication in the Little Review, he urge Joyce to obscure this scene a bit more in an effort to clean up Ulysses for the Little Review's readership. At least Ezra Pound found this scene to be a bit too much. So if we remember at the end, I want to know if you agree with Mr. Pound or not.
So a little Nazi thought it was a little nasty. All right, mm-hmm. Fine.
Well, let's read the first little bit here.
The cat, having cleaned all her fur, returned to the meat-stained paper, nosed at it, and stalked to the door. She looked back at him, mewing. Wants to go out. Wait before a door. Sometime it'll open. Let her wait. Has the fidgets. Electric. Thunder in the air. Was washing at her ear with her back to the fire, too. He felt heavy, full, then a gentle loosening of his bowels. He stood up, undoing the waistband of his trousers. The cat mewed to him.
Meow,
he said in answer. Wait till I'm ready. Heaviness, hot day coming. Too much trouble to fag up the stairs to the landing.
All right, thank you, Dermot. Thoughts?
It seems straightforward. He's got a poo on the way.
Mm-hmm.
He says that or wait, has the fidgets. The cat has the fidgets or does he have the fidgets?
I think the cat. Because then he mentions her washing her ear.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like a cat, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then he goes on to the meteorology. Was washing at her ear with her back to the fire, too. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that seems clear.
Yeah, I don't... Actually, most of this section, I don't have a whole lot to say. So we'll probably go through a lot of this quickly, and then we'll talk about Freud. So a couple... Just two notes I have on this section that I wrote down. One, thunder in the air is foreshadowing of the storm later in the day. Mm-hmm. This big thunderstorm. Also, just noting that too much trouble to fag up the stairs to the landing. So that might be a phrase that our American listenership isn't familiar with. What does that mean?
Fagging. A fag in English public schools was a young boy who was a servant to an older boy. Mm-hmm. And fagging was like a rite of passage kind of thing is how I understand it. Mm-hmm. So I think in this context, it's just used to like drudge work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he doesn't want to drag himself up the stairs.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the origin of the F word for gay people or not. Maybe.
Yeah, but this has nothing to do with gay people.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm just saying that's why they'll be familiar mm-hmm. with it. Fag is also a cigarette. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the etymology of that is for a cigarette, but lovely fags being another Father
yes,
Ted.
From Father yes. Ted. Right, so something I noticed here is that this is implying that the Blooms have an indoor toilet as mm-hmm. well as an outhouse and a chamber pot. So there's lots of pooping options in the Bloom household. Mm-hmm. If you want a meticulously detailed article on what the indoor toileting situation would have been like in the row houses on Eccles Street circa 1904, there is a... Like I said, a very detailed article on James Joyce online notes, and I will put that in the further reading section of our show notes so you can read that. I'm not going to go into it here, but if you're curious, you can check that out. That site is always very detailed and very good. All right, let's read the next.
A paper. He liked to read at stool. Hope no ape comes knocking just as I'm in. In the table drawer, he found an old number of titbits. He folded it under his armpit, went up to the door and opened it. The cat went up in soft bounds. Ah, wanted to go upstairs, curl up in a ball on the bed. Listening, he heard her voice. Come, come, pussy, come. He went out of the back door into the garden, stood to listen towards the next garden. No sound. Perhaps hanging clothes out to dry. The maid was in the garden. Fine morning.
All right, thoughts on that?
Again, clear enough. I think, is this like a shared toilet? Like there's more than one person can use it? Is that what he's getting
mm-hmm.
at?
Yeah, that's what I would think so.
Mm.
Although the 7 Eccles Street is a single-family home, as we learned in our episode entitled 7 Eccles Street. It was not always, but I don't know if the outhouse is shared amongst the row houses there.
Mm.
This kind of implies it. I don't think he's referring to Molly as an ape that's going to come knocking on the door.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that must be it.
And Tippett's, I know from, we've talked about it before, yes. it's a sort of a saucy magazine or a periodical or sort of a tabloidy kind of compendium of stories.
Here's what we need to know about Tippett's. So the full title of Tippett's was Tippett's from all the most interesting books, periodicals, and newspapers in the world. You can find compendiums of it. It was a very long-running periodical, started in 1881. definitely the Joyce family read it. Stanislaus Joyce, in his biography of his brother, my brother's keeper, said that, I can't remember quite how he put it, but something along the lines of, it's the only way their father, John Joyce, kept up with culture,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a bit of a dig. But I think what we're meant to take away from... Tidbits in 1904 would have been pretty chaste. I think the name of it is meant to be a little titillating. It was just enough of a double entendre for Victorian and Edwardian men to be a little bit thrilled by it.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of double entendre in this, too, I think Come, Come, Pussy from Molly is probably also one of those. Let's see here. In Gifford and Seidman's annotation of Ulysses, they said, "Some historians of journalism suggest that popular modern journalism was born with the first issue of Tidbits in 1881. Basically, it's a bit lowbrow. Many articles were about a paragraph long, so it's not super complex or detailed. Jokes were its main point of interest. It cost a penny. It was printed on cheap paper. Thus, it ends up being toilet paper for the Blooms."
Mm.
Yeah, later on, I think that they moved more into tits and less into bits. I think starting in the late 30s, it became more like photo bits, which if you want to know about photo bits, check out our episode, Met Him Pycoses. They're not related at all.
Okay.
But they were more like pictures of large-breasted women and bikinis and things like that. That would be long after Mr. Bloom's time. We'll see what it's like in a minute here. Let's keep reading.
He bent down to regard a lean file of spearmint growing by the wall. "Make a summer house here. Scarlet runners. Virginia creepers. Want to manure the whole place over scabby soil. A coat of liver of sulfur. All soil like that without dung. Household slops. Loam. What is this that is? The hens in the next garden. Their droppings are very good top dressing. Best of all, though, are the cattle, especially when they're fed on those oil cakes. Mulch of dung. Best thing to clean ladies' kid gloves. Dirty cleans. Ashes, too. Reclaim the whole place. Grow peas in that corner there. Lettuce. Always have fresh greens then. Still, gardens have their drawbacks. That bee or blue bottle here, Whit Monday."
All right. Thank you, Dermot. Thoughts?
Yeah, again, this is kind of remind me of the all of his like gardening or his plans for Palestine when he wants to, when he's thinking of like having a farm there, and this is the closest probably that he's ever going to come to it if he can, like a few square feet of a backyard garden, making his own lettuce, better project. So he's and it's practical, like he's already looking at the crappy soil, what it's going to take to amend all that. Nothing's going to grow in dirt. Let's see, some of it I wasn't sure about. I don't know what a Virginia creeper is.
It's a plant.
Okay.
Scarlet runners and Virginia creepers are both plants.
And a coat of liver of sulfur, I have no idea what that is.
Liver of sulfur, I believe, is something you add to the soil as a fertilizer.
Okay. Let's see. Oil cakes, no idea what that is. Clean ladies, kid gloves. Dirty cleans. I guess, you're cleaning something with dung. Yeah. Yeah, that seems sensible enough. That beer blue bottle here, Whit Monday, I'm not sure what that would refer to.
Well, let's start with that. Whit Monday is the day after Whit Sunday,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, obviously.
Whit Sunday being the seventh Sunday after Easter, and in 1904 that would have been the 23rd of May. I mean, not that interesting unless you're really interested in the dates of movable feasts throughout history.
Mm.
But Bloom was stung by a bee on Whit Monday this year, so he's kind of, that's memorable for him. Yeah, he's really, I'd say, dung and related topics. Yeah, a lot of dung in this kind of is creeping into his mind. He's thinking a lot about poo, basically. Here, specifically, how it's useful
mm-hmm.
as fertilizer. And then he says you can use the mulch made from dung of cattle, I guess, who've been fed on oil cakes, to clean ladies' kid gloves. And he says, dirty cleans. This reminds me, too, of there's a line in Lotus Eaters where he says, the opposite is the cure,
mm-hmm.
which I guess is a homeopathic belief. So I think a little bit of that belief's snuck up here, too. Mm-hmm. So if something is dirty, it'll make it clean, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Let's read the next one.
He walked on. "Where is my hat, by the way? Must have put it back on the peg, or hanging up on the floor. Funny, I don't remember that. Hall stand too full. Four umbrellas, her raincloak. Picking up the letters. Drago's shop bell ringing. Queer, I was just thinking that moment. Brown, brilliantined hair over his collar. Just had a wash and brush up. Wonder, have I time for a bath this morning? Tara Street. Chap in the pay box there. Got away, James Stevens, they say. O'Brien.
Any thoughts?
Okay, so he's looking for his hat. Can't find it. It sounds like he's just running through and all the stuff he's seeing around him. Drago's shop bell ringing. I'm assuming this is a place he visited.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if he's trying to figure out if he left his hat there or not. Brown, brilliantined hair over his collar. Tara Street. Yeah, I know Tara Street well.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the train stops, the dart. Chap in the pay box there got away. James Stevens, they say. O'Brien. And that's a reference to somebody that I do not know.
All right. Well, Drago's is a hairdresser at 17 at Dawson Street.
Mm-hmm.
James Stevens was in the 1860s the chief organizer and first head center of the Fenian Society. Who were the Fenians?
Oh, early Irish movement fighting for independence.
Mm-hmm. And he famously escaped from Richmond Jail in 1865. And Bloom is thinking that the guy who works in the pay box at the bath in Tara Street helped James Stevens escape from jail.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks O'Brien. And in my Gifford and Sideman here, it says that J.P. O'Brien was a superintendent at the Dublin Corporation Public Baths, Wash Houses, and Public Swimming Baths in Tara Street.
Hmm.
There are a couple of men named O'Brien that were associated with Stevens, but neither of them helped with his escape. So this is kind of just garbled Bloom half
okay.
rememberings. His mnemotechnic is not working at the moment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's about it.
Okay. So that bath's long gone, I presume, because mm-hmm. I don't recall ever, back in the 80s either, I don't recall a bath.
I think a lot of public baths
gone.
You know, went the way of Queen Victoria.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's continue.
Deep voice that Lugach has. I can death, what is it? Now my miss. Enthusiast. He kicked open the crazy door of the Jake's. Better be careful not to get those trousers dirty for the funeral. He went in, bowing his head under the low lintel. Leaving the door ajar amid the stench of mouldy lime wash and stale cobwebs, he undid his braces. Before sitting down, he peered through a chink up at the next door windows. The king was in his counting house. Nobody.
Any thoughts on this?
Do cobwebs have a funny smell?
Stale cobwebs? Does stale mean smell to you?
Oh, because he says the stench of mouldy lime wash and stale cobwebs. Mm-hmm. So I read that as the stench of mouldy lime wash and the stench of stale cobwebs.
Ah.
So I hope cobwebs don't stink. No, I think it's just he's laying it on. Let's see. So he's looking up to make sure no one's looking in at him. Is there like a gap in the door? That'd be weird.
I think he's just kind of look. It says it's a chink in the wood.
Uh-huh.
You can just kind of see through it. But I wouldn't think they'd be able to see back in.
Yeah.
Any meaningful detail.
Yeah. I get paranoid about people being able to see through frosted glass windows and toilets. I hate that. Yeah, so he's flashing back to Glugach the butcher, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he's selling the sausages. And again, he's calling him an enthusiast, which isn't a good thing. Mm-hmm. In this period, like in the Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander books, mere enthusiasm was a put down. Being an enthusiast was not a good thing. And it meant you had a shallow interest in something. Mm-hmm. So he thinks, oh, he just like the thing. Like, and Bloom as well. Like when it comes to Zionism, I think he's an enthusiast as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to do the hard work. The Jakes, we used to call them the Jacks when I was a kid, mm-hmm. not Jakes. So, but I can tell the meaning of that. Yeah, that's about it.
The Jakes. I'm not sure why it's Jakes. All I could find looking through online dictionaries is that's kind of an archaic word for an outhouse. Yeah, Jacks is I've heard much more. And from mm-hmm. what I can tell, Jacks is much more common usage.
Yep.
I noticed here that he said he kicked open the door, so he didn't want to use his hand to open that door.
Mm-hmm.
Bloom's very neat and tidy.
Mm.
Let's keep going.
A squat on the cook stool, he folded out his paper, turning its pages over on his bared knees. Something new and easy. No great hurry. keep it a bit. Our prize tidbit, Matcham's Masterstroke, written by Mr. Philip Beaufoy, Playgoers Club, London. Payment at the rate of 1 guinea a column has been made to the writer. 3.5. £3.03. £3.13.6.
Thoughts?
So some details of, I guess, so Matcham's Masterstroke is, I guess, just one of these stories in the in tidbits.
Yeah.
Is Philip Beaufoy real?
Yes.
So we know exactly what this piece is?
Yes.
And I would think that's good money for the time. £3.03. That, I mean, my grandfather made £10 a week as a butcher in Ireland in the 1940s.
To put it in perspective of Ulysses, Stephen earns £4 a month for teaching.
Good God. Yeah, this is that's a good deal. Granted, you wouldn't be making, you know, this kind of money writing every week, so it's not necessarily a weekly rate, but it's a nice side deal if you can get it. Cookstool, I would have thought was something to do with cuckoldry, but I don't know. Sounds like it. I've never heard that word. Yeah, that's about me.
Right. Wiped. Well, let's start with cookstool. I found there are various interpretations of this. But from the Joyce Project's website, he cites that it comes from a Middle English term, cucking stool, meaning excreting stool, or as he also wrote, shitting stool. Mm-hmm. It's basically the place where you sit and take a poo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is used here because it echoes cuckold.
Mm, okay.
The more common use of the word cuck. That's about it. It's this place where he's going to sit and take a poo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this was apparently, as far as titbits goes, this was apparently the real payment, which is something that Joyce would have definitely known. Mm-hmm. We'll see. Keep in mind Matcham's Masterstroke. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next section. Stanislaus Joyce said that Philip Beaufoy was a real person whose stories were frequently published in titbits, and kind of keeping in mind the sensibility of the Joyce brothers and the reputation of titbits. Yeah, that
right.
He kind of would have. His writing probably wasn't
great.
Yeah.
But he's making money.
But it's good enough for titbits. Yeah. It's the kind of writing that makes money.
Mm-hmm. Quietly he read, restraining himself, the first column, and, yielding but resisting, began the second. Midway, his last resistance yielding, he allowed his bowels to ease themselves quietly as he read, reading still patiently, that slight constipation of yesterday quite gone. Hope it's not too big. Bring on piles again. Nope, just right. So, costive. One tabloid of Cascara Sagrada. Life might be so. It did not move or touch him, but it was something quick and neat. Print anything now. Silly season. He read on, seated calm above his own rising smell. Neat, certainly. Matcham often thinks of the masterstroke by which he won the laughing witch who now begins and ends morally. Hand in hand. Smart. He glanced back through what he had read, and, while feeling his water flow quietly, he envied kindly Mr. Beaufoy, who had written it and received payment of £3.13.6.
Take it away, Dermot.
The poo has landed. Luckily, he didn't suffer Poseidon's kiss, thank Christ.
I don't know what that means.
Poseidon's kiss is when your poo drops in the water and a little glob of water goes up your bum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Send the kids to bed early, everybody. I warned you.
I dread Poseidon's kiss. It's terrible. I have no idea what one tabloid of Cascara Sagrada is, but I'd love to ask for one in Sweeney's the next time we're in
there. I think PJ would. He'd at least know what you're referring to.
He would absolutely know.
It's a bark of a tree that is used as a...
Laxative?
I was going to say, what do you call a medicine that makes you go poo? Yes, a laxative.
Life might be so. I'm not sure what exactly he means by that. When he says, it did not move or touch him, but it was something quick and neat. That's a story, right? Like
The story.
Yeah.
And the poo.
Oh, as here, so there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Silly season. Yeah. We still have them.
Well, how would you describe silly season?
Usually it's a certain time of the year when there's not much happening and people print anything in the news.
Mm-hmm.
So he quotes a line from, I assume this is a real quote from, Matcham often thinks of the masterstroke by which he won the laughing witch, who now. Yeah, it's kind of, what's the guy who, it was a dark and stormy night, Lytton Button. Lytton Butter, Bulmer, Lytton, the guy who wrote the most awful opening lines in history, yeah. Begins and ends morally. So I guess it's like he's pulling on Victorian morality in
and
the story.
And again, a hint to our grand finale today that I believe references to Matcham's Masterstroke and Bloom's Masterstroke. His bow. Yeah, it's very interesting how he's reading this story that's kind of shit, juxtaposed with him taking a shit, mm-hmm. and all of the descriptions describe both his shit and the shit story.
Mm.
That is the implication here.
Right.
Any other thoughts?
And then, oh, he envied kindly Mr. Beaufort. I wonder. There could be some good Irish begrudgery there. I hope you choke on your £3.13 and 6. Because he's awfully specific about that.
That's a big Simon Dedalus energy there. This is Bloom is usually pretty
gentle.
Bloom
is nicer. But Dedalus would. He would hate this guy.
Bloom spends the rest of the day like thinking of what his Titbits story could be about.
Okay.
Because he realizes that Titbits' sensibility can be manipulated to make him money.
Yes, he's so, trying to like deconstruct the formula so he can profit from it.
Yeah. So we talk about kind of the ways in which Bloom and Stephen's minds intersect. So they both want to be writers, but Stephen wants to be this high art, intellectual, starving poet. And Bloom is like, how can I write the treacliest, crowd-pleasingest short story to get it in the Titbits and get my £3.13 and 6? I think when he's saying he envied him kindly, right, he wants what Mr. Beaufoy has, but he's not really begrudging him because he's like, I can crack this code. It's just Titbits. Let's talk about Matcham's Masterstroke. So the lines were taken from a story that Joyce wrote and submitted to Titbits when he was a student at Belvedere. I don't remember if the story was actually called Matcham's Masterstroke. I don't think it was. But the lines that you see italicized in this section are pulled verbatim from his story, and they're believed to be the first and last lines of his story, which is some... Stanislaus writes about it. So if you want to read this story, it's in his book, which you can find online. He writes about it as Joyce wasn't super interested in plot-heavy stories. Like, Ulysses has almost no plot. It's a lot more about incident and, like, internal stream of consciousness and, you know, these big themes. So he says his brother was kind of playing with writing these very meticulously plotted stories. Not quite genre fiction, but, like, in the neighborhood. And he wrote this and had a friend using a pseudonym take it to Titbits for him so that like the stink of Titbits wouldn't be on the name of Joyce,
right,
even indirectly. But according to Stanislaus, this story was written as a quote, as a joke and as an experiment in raising the wind.
Also, if he got £3.13 and 6...
Yeah.
All the better.
Considering he was selling his stories that would ultimately become Dubliners to Constantine Curran at UCD at that time for £1 a story. That's
good God. Yeah, yeah. And this guy gets £3.13 and 6. I'm begrudging now. I'm begrudge for Joyce. Yeah.
It'd be a pretty big windfall.
Yeah.
It didn't get published though. It's like Roger Ebert always sending in New Yorker cartoon captions and never getting one published.
Never mind those guys. Ourselves. Yeah. They're not funny.
All right, next.
Might manage a sketch by Mr. and Mrs. L.M. Bloom. Invent a story for some proverb. Which? Time I used to try jotting down on my cuff what she said dressing. Dislike dressing together. Nicked myself shaving. Biting her nether lip. Hooking the placket of her skirt. Timing her. 9:15. Did Roberts pay you yet? 9:20. What had Greta Conroy on? 9:23. What possessed me to buy this comb? 9:24. I'm swelled after that cabbage. A speck of dust on the patent leather of her boot.
Thoughts?
Jesus. he says he doesn't like getting dressed with his wife. Nicked himself shaving, probably because she was distracting him. Oh yeah, and he'd have had one of those terrifying open face straight razors. Yeah, you could really hurt yourself with them. Biting her nether lip. hooking the placket of her skirt, and then all the... So she's basically, like, giving him grief. Did Roberts pay you yet? And then 5 minutes later, interrogations, 9:23. She's angry at herself, 9:24. She's angry at herself. Yeah, and he's a speck of dust on the patent leather of her boot. Yeah, so he has a pretty sharp opinion of her, his role in her life. Yeah.
So what is happening here is that he's sort of brainstorming what could inspire that prize titbit story. And they say we could write it as Mr. and Mrs. L. M. Bloom, Leopold Molly, pseudonym, kind of. Maybe I could, you know, like have a proverb that becomes a story, but which one? And then he's remembering a time that he used to try and like jot down on the cuff of his shirt all of Molly's little witticisms and quotes. Mm-hmm. So he's not getting dressed at the same time she is because they dislike getting dressed together. It's not clear who or both or which dislikes it, but he's sitting there waiting for her to get dressed. So he's marking the time and then like writing down the things that she said, hoping there'll be some inspiration there of some maybe kind of quirky husband and wife story that they could write or something you could connect to a proverb.
Yeah.
But it's all just Molly complaining.
It's horrible.
Do you recognize the name Greta Conroy?
I don't.
I'll give you a hint. She's a wife to Gabriel. Gabriel Conroy.
It's not coming to me.
They're the couple from the dead.
Oh, that's right.
And she's a singer, just like Molly.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay.
No, so it's just Molly. I don't get that she's like henpecking Bloom. I get it. She's just... her outer monologue is like her inner monologue. It just rolls on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Did Roberts pay you yet? What did Greta Conroy have on? Oh, what possessed me to buy this comb? Oh, I'm so swelled out. She's having trouble getting to her dress. Like, I've got nothing to wear. This comb's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't get the impression she's throwing a big tantrum. I think she's just commenting on her environment.
Just grumpy, but grouchy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hasn't had her coffee yet.
Okay, two more sections.
Rubbing smartly in turn, each welt against her stocking calf. Morning after the bazaar dance, when May's band played Punky Ellie's Dance of the Hours. Explain that. Morning hours, noon, and then evening coming on, then night hours. Washing her teeth. That was the first night, her head dancing, her fan sticks clicking. Is that Boylan well off? He has money. Why? I noticed he had a good rich smell off his breath dancing. No use humming then. Allude to it. Strange kind of music, that last night. The mirror was in shadow. She rubbed her hand glass briskly on her woolen vest against her full wagging bub, peering into it, lines in her eyes. It wouldn't pan out somehow. Evening hours, girls in grey gauze. Night hours then, black with daggers and eye masks. Poetical idea. Pink, then golden, then grey, then black. Still, true to life also. Day, then the night. He tore away half the prize story sharply and wiped himself with it. Then he girded up his trousers, braced and buttoned himself. He pulled back the jerky, shaky door of the Jakes and came forth from the gloom into the air.
Thoughts?
This kind of loses me after he's doing this morning, hours, noon business.
Mm-hmm.
I can follow some of it, but I'm not sure the allusion to the hours.
Mm-hmm.
Washing her teeth, that was the first night. Fan sticks clicking, does Molly have fans or was it like fucking flamenco thing? Boylan, I think, is that her asking about Blazes Boylan? Does he have money? But I don't know how we've segged into this. I've kind of, you know,
okay.
I'm kind of rolling a bit here. She rubbed her hand glass briskly on her woolen vest. A wagging bub. What's a wagging?
That's her boob.
Her boob. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought
boobs
so.
Are bubs.
I thought so. Ulysses, okay. Yeah. Okay. But guess that might have been. Girls in grey gauze. No idea where this is coming from. And then, of course, I get that he tore away the titbit story and used it as toilet paper.
Yes.
That's nice.
Take that, Mr. Beaufoy. Nice.
Up yours and your £3.16 and three or whatever the hell it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so it all kind of hinges on you being familiar with Ponchielli's Dance of the Hours, which is a ballet.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dance that he attended with Molly back in May, where she first met Blazes Boylan. And a lot of this, the evening hours, Girls in Grey Gauze. So I guess this ballet, I'm not super familiar with it, but there's a long dance interlude in the middle that's the dance of the hours. So it's dancers come out in gray, and then they transition, like, following the colors of a sunrise and then into night. So that's what that's all about. He's remembering the ballet, but then he's also remembering that she... You know, she meets Blazes, and she's like, ooh, is he rich? You know, I noticed he had a good rich smell off his breath dancing, so there might have been other music and dancing, too. Maybe she danced with him.
Mm-hmm.
The mirror was in shadow, so she has a little hand mirror, and I think it's kind of, you know, there's a smudge on it. She wipes it on her boob. She looked into it. She's trying to, like, see if she looks good.
Right.
Because she wants to look good for... Boylan. And then still true to life, also day then the night. So that's their life, right? That's their married life together, day and then the night. And he's kind of like pulling this metaphor out of this dance sequence, and then he just shuts it down. He tore away the paper, he wipes himself, and then kicks the door back. Well, he pulls back the door and then comes forth from the gloom into the air. So he's like kind of almost running away from these dark thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. Last little bit here, and then you've finished Calypso.
In the bright light, lightened and cooled in limb, he eyed carefully his black trousers, the ends, the knees, the hocks of the knees. What time is the funeral? Better find out in the paper. A creak and a dark whir in the air high up. The bells of George's church. They tolled the hour. Loud, dark iron. Hey-ho, 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 hey-ho. Quarter two, there again. The overtone following through the air, a third. Poor Dignam.
So ends Calypso.
Okay.
Your thoughts?
Did I pronounce hey-ho correctly?
Hey-ho, yeah.
Okay.
But you didn't sing it correctly. We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
What do you think about this before I tell you what to think?
That seems obvious. Like, he's just hocks of the knees. That's the back of the knee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this old Dignam guy is dead. Funeral's coming up. And he can hear the bell, real bells then. They weren't using bloody speakers like they do now.
Yeah, that's the creak and the whir is the bells.
The machinery kicking in. Yeah. Or the people, like, actually having to, like, yank
a thing. Yeah. Yep, that'd be my thought.
Yeah. I remember they used to have bell ringing practice in the Protestant church in my hometown. And you could hear them on whatever day, Saturday or whatever, and you hear the ding, wah, 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 and that would go on for, like, an hour or two as they were, you know, getting the groove. I think it doesn't happen anymore. It's all recorded.
I remember a person would pull the bells in the church where I went to church as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Mosques are the same, too. The call to prayer is, like, recording. Yeah. There's no muezzin in there anymore.
Well, this is not a call to prayer. This is bells marking the hour, because before most people had clocks or watches or smartphones, they would use bells, or sometimes like a civic building would have a bell tower, and they'd chime the hours, and often they would chime in what are known as Westminster quarters, which you listening might not know that term, but you definitely know what it is. It's that little tune that goes, do, 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 do. Instead of subjecting more of my bads off-tune singing, there's a video of the Westminster Cathedral bells playing it.
Right. So this should be, hey ho, hey ho, hey ho, hey ho. Okay, I get it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And there's one for quarter hour, half past, quarter two, and the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they go one measure, two measure, three measure, four measure. So the hour's four measures.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a slightly different tune in each. And so Bloom's able to see, oh, it has three rings. You know, there's three measures of the song, so it's 8:45.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Does it start at 8 a.m.?
Okay.
Now, here's where it gets interesting. Bloom renders their song as hey ho, hey ho. In Telemachus, there's a point where Stephen kind of offers his own interpretation on this by reciting part of the prayer for the dying, which when we talked about this, we just mentioned what the Latin means and that it's the prayer that would have been said over his mother. And he says, Liliata rutilantium, terma curcumdet, jubilantium te virginum. Three lines of a much longer text. So it's like, why would Stephen say those three? And it's because he's using this to match to the bells of a church ringing in Kingstown, now Dunleary. And he offers three lines because he's hearing three measures of the song, or three bars. I can't remember bars and measures, but he's hearing three little segments of the song. And because it's three, he knows it's also 8:45. So Bloom and Stephen are both noting the time of 8:45 at the same time. Hypostasis? If you'd like to know more about hypostasis, please check out our episode called Who is That Dan Occam Fellow? Anyway, now, do you think I'm overthinking this?
No.
And you know that I'm not, because I have a quote here I'm going to make you read.
Mm-hmm.
Ithaca to the rescue. So Dharma's going to read a quote from Ithaca, the penultimate chapter or episode of Ulysses. Go ahead.
What sound accompanied the union of their tangent, the disunion of their respectively centrifugal and centripetal hands? The sound of the peal of the hour of the night by the chime of the bells in the church of St. George. What echoes of that sound were by both and each heard? By Stephen, Liliata rutilantium.
Liliata rutilantium terma cocumdet, jubilantium te virginum chorus escipiat. If I ever need to summon demons, I'm not going to ask you for help. That's all I'm saying.
We're going to go with your reading. Uh-huh. And by Bloom, hey, 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 ho, hey, ho, hey, ho. Okay.
And you'll notice this one now is four measures,
mm-hmm,
because it's 2 a.m., so it's chiming the hour.
Okay.
So the number of phrases is different, right? So Stephen has four lines of the prayer. Bloom has four hey-hos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Although really it's only kind of two hey-hos, because he does hey-ho couplets, but whatever. It's meant to show that Stephen has this very highfalutin Catholic way of marking the time, and Bloom just says hey-ho, hey-ho, hey-ho. kind of like a nursery rhyme or something, mm-hmm, or like the dwarves from Snow White.
I was thinking that.
Wouldn't exist for another 30
hey-ho,
years.
It's off to Joyce we go. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. It might be hi-ho, I don't know.
It's hi-ho, yeah.
So I've proven to you that Stephen and Bloom are experiencing a hypostatic connection.
QED.
QED. What time is the funeral is that other question I alluded to. When we next meet Bloom, he will have a newspaper in hand and an answer to that question.
Hmm.
It doesn't seem interesting now, but at some point in our Lotus Eaters discussion, it will be. Any thoughts about Calypso or this passage in particular?
No, it seems clear.
Yeah, so there's a lot of details in here that I'm really excited to talk about that we kind of skimmed over. I think this is going to end up being a little bit long episode, but it's going to be worth it. And this section of my notes is entitled Dr. Freud and Bloom's Poo. And our first bullet point under that is filth. So let's talk about filth. So Joyce thought that it was an artist's duty to act as a conduit for filth, for the filth of society. If you'd like to know more about that, we did a full episode on this idea entitled The Holy Office, so go check that out. He felt that realism and obscenity were necessary to an artist's work. And his friend Frank Budgen wrote the following.
The life of Ulysses comes first and the philosophy afterwards. Obscenity is a question of manners and conventions forever changing. Virtuosity, if it stood alone, would soon become demoded, and philosophy too. But living character stays through whatever material is presented.
Right, and that living character is portraying real life, and a very meticulous catalog of things one might do in real life, which includes pooping.
Mm.
So Joyce and his most famous creation, Leopold Bloom, are very anally fixated. If you've ever watched one of those internet videos where people read Joyce's dirty love letters to Nora, you can easily find them. I will link one in our show notes, because I have one that I regularly link in our, mm-hmm, our blog post.
What about the one of you reading them?
I don't think that's available anywhere that isn't my private Google Drive.
Mm-mm.
For I teach teenagers, and I would like them to never find them. they are better than me at the internet. But Bloom is very anally fixated. He spends a lot of time in this passage thinking about his poo, I saw lots of Pooh references blended in with the rest of his kind of jabbering thoughts in mm-hmm. this, and I was very disciplined in not mentioning them, except for that one passage, but I just really like how the tidbit story, the description of the tidbit story could also be a description of his Pooh.
Hmm.
So, was Joyce into Freud? This is the second episode in a row where we're talking about Freud. Outwardly, no. Joyce outwardly, publicly dismissed Freud. I think in a letter where he referred to Freud as the Austrian Tweedledum to the Swiss Tweedledee Carl Jung.
Jesus.
He really didn't have much time for psychoanalysis. He once told his friend Ettore Schmitz, a.k.a. Talos Svevo, a.k.a. model for Leopold Bloom, that rather than go to psychoanalysis, you'd be better off just going to confession. And he didn't really disagree with Freud's ideas, per se, though. Like, he didn't say Freud was a quack. He just felt that the ideas that Freud wrote about had already been expressed better by the likes of people like Giordano Bruno, Giambattista Vico, and the Catholic Church.
Yeah, he was wrong there.
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, I've heard enough about Bruno. Bruno was a magician. Mm-hmm. You know, Bruno wasn't a psychoanalyst or a alienist, as they call mm-hmm. them, you know. And also, like, Jung and Freud have similarities, but more differences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Vico, but the Catholic Church, nah, not when it comes to, like, deep diving into the human unconscious. I think mm-hmm. the Catholic Church has much interest in the human unconscious. Mm-hmm. They want to know what your rational mind thinks, and all the irrational stuff is sin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, Joyce had a way of taking large concepts like this, and I would include in that list of concepts, Catholicism, occultism,
mm-hmm.
Also psychoanalysts, and he would embrace the parts that interest him and then flatly reject the parts that didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So the aspects of psychoanalysis that really interested Joyce were the analysis of dreams,
mm-hmm.
Free association, and the revealing of the symbolism of the unconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to defer to Stanislaus once more here. He said in his biography,
"My brother, regarding psychology, which he was then studying as the basis of philosophy, and words in the hands of an artist as the medium of paramount importance for a right understanding of the inmost life of the soul. The revelation of that inmost life was, my brother firmly believed, the poet's high office."
He found some inspiration in psychology,
mm-hmm.
right? Understanding the mind. And, I mean, that's certainly what he was trying to do in right. Ulysses, and in a very different way in Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, with plumbing the depths of the human mind, let's talk about butt stuff. Specifically, Freudian take on butt stuff.
Yeah.
Freud wrote an article in 1908 entitled Character and Anal Erotism, which I read in full. Not because I'm a masochist, but because I care about you listeners and I care about the integrity of this podcast.
She read it so that you don't have to.
Yeah. In this article, Freud if you would like to read it, it's an odd little piece of work. I don't know how you feel about anal erotism, but I will just say my views and Freud's views are not the same views. But if you'd like to read it, it's available for free online, and I will include a link in our show notes. In this article from 1908, Freud outlined how one's childhood relationship with their own anus would impact their character as an adult. He believed humans universally pass through a series of developmental stages as infants and young children. So oral stage, anal stage. I feel like there's another one that I can't remember.
There's four, I think, or yeah. Three or four. Yeah. Ego or superego.
But in each of these stages, they kind of are fixated on a certain body part. Around the age of two comes the anal stage. This is the point in our development where we humans gain control of our bowels and become fascinated by their product.
Mm-hmm.
Freud saw this as the first major power struggle of our young lives, that we now, as two-year-olds, have the ability to manage our own bowels. We're potty trained, but there is an authority figure trying to control where and when we void our own bowels.
Hitler.
A child who responds to this by choosing to withhold their feces, who takes pleasure in holding back the sensation of releasing their bowels, is described by Freud as anal retentive. I believe the opposite of this is anal explosive. We're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the anal retentive. Because this article, Freud saw, I will just say up front, Freud saw these anal retentive characteristics we're about to talk about as very connected to homosexual activity. And it's a very stereotypical view. If you want to know more about anal sex as it relates to Ulysses, I strongly recommend you check out the blog post that is connected to this podcast episode, which is entitled In the Jakes with Mr. Bloom. So here we're just going to talk about Freud's description of the anal retentive person and try to figure out whether or not it describes Leopold Bloom. If you want to know more about Bloom's sexuality connected to his anus, check out that blog post, because we're already over time. All right, so back to anal retentive persons. Such a person who took pleasure in holding back on releasing their bowels, Freud described as someone who will generally be, quote, especially orderly, parsimonious, and obstinate. So do these three qualities apply to Bloom? So we're going to look at each one separately, and we'll kind of restrict our discussion to Calypso just for today's episode, because you could look at this across Ulysses. There are many examples of all of these, but we can't be here for 6 hours. Dermot and I have lives to lead outside of this podcast and not just talking about Leopold Bloom's poop. All right. Is he orderly? Do you think Bloom is orderly?
Reasonably, yeah.
Yeah. Let's look at, one example from Calypso. See how he prepares Molly's breakfast, just so, right? He says, quote, another slice of bread and butter, 3, 4, right. She didn't like her plate full. He's very orderly. He's doing it just so. If we expand the definition of orderliness to mean cleanliness and neatness, then Bloom is definitely orderly, as he has a very deep appreciation for cleanliness, even the dirtiest of things. In the section we just read, he says, mulch of dung, best thing to clean ladies' kid gloves, dirty cleans. He can even find cleanliness and order in filth. In Laestrygonians, I think the best example of this in the whole book is that Bloom flees the sloppy cacophony of the Burton restaurant for the tidy confines of what he calls the moral pub, Davy Burns. And keep an eye on that moral.
Hmm.
You'll find things that fall under these three descriptors, Bloom tends to connect with morality. Which cleanliness is morality is a very Victorian worldview. Talk about that in Lotus Eaters when we get to the bath scene. Do you agree that he's orderly?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, he's lost a couple of things, but he's not like, complete control freak. But I would say, yeah, more so than not, yeah.
Yeah, he leaves his key behind, but it's because he breaks his routine, right? He puts on different pants.
Mm. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
All right, parsimonious. Parsimonious, when I first read this, I was like, I don't know if he's parsimonious. It generally means someone who's excessively frugal.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bloom's willing to indulge a little bit. He does things that are just kind of nice.
Mm.
He goes out of his way to buy that lemon soap for Molly and get her some frilly violet garters later on and a copy of Sweets of Sin.
He's not gambling. He's not going down to...
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't really drink or gamble. Actually, his lack of interest in gambling gets him into a lot of trouble later.
Right.
But if you take parsimonious to mean that he's very occupied with money, it's not just frugality, just a preoccupation with money and how much things cost, and economics, the art of Calypso, Bloom is certainly parsimonious. So spend any time in Bloom's head, it will allow you to learn the cost of each and every small thing he encounters throughout the day. So in Calypso, it's everything from the expense of a ticket to visiting Millie and Mullingar, which maybe he could even get a press pass and go for free, or, bug McCoy and get something, to the exact prize money for publishing a story in Titbits, £3, 13, and 6, which is his main fixation with Titbits, It's not because he's like, wow, to have my name in you know, in publication, or to have my art where everyone can see. He doesn't care about any of that. Mm-hmm. He's like, how can I twist this tidbits to wring a little bit of money out of it, you know? Right. And a lot of Freud's anal retentive qualities are related to control, to someone who reacted to this very early power struggle by being like, F you, Mom, I'm holding it in, you know, instead of just, but the opposite of that, someone who's kind of explosive is like, let it out and go everywhere. This is more like, hold it in, very, you know, I have control of the situation, not you, Mom, I have control, I decide when I poop. And that's kind of spilled over into these other areas. So whether through keeping one's space tidy and orderly or controlling the flow of their money, these are ways that anal retentive person would show control around their environs. And there are aspects of Bloom's life right now that have spun totally out of his control. Millie being away in Mullingar, Molly and Boylan, focusing on something controllable like finance and economics. Allows him to keep his mind calm as he kind of navigates his other daily routines. Do you think he's parsimonious?
Yeah.
You were kind of sold on that one up top.
Yeah.
Now, do you think he's obstinate?
Which
obstinate means like stubborn, right?
I haven't seen enough of him to be 100% on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wouldn't find him a particularly stubborn man.
Mm.
An aspect of stubbornness, though, is attempting to maintain control when an outside force is trying to upset your established order, either for better or for worse.
Mm.
Which I think that's a little bit closer to Bloom is. I don't think he's particularly stubborn, but in this case, obstinacy means sticking to a course of action beyond reason.
Mm.
In Bloom's case, that would be his denial around Molly's infidelity. You see how quick he starts thinking about Boylan, he starts getting down, and then he's like, F it, and he just rips the newspaper, wipes himself, and goes back out into the light. He doesn't want to think about it, and he shuts it down over and over and over. Does not want to think about Boylan. He knows what's going on between them, and he continually snaps his mind away because he doesn't want to get too close to the truth. The truth is too painful. Why doesn't Bloom confront Molly or leave her altogether? Many critics will see this as evidence of Bloom's feminized and passive nature, but I don't know that I see that as an aspect of femininity, but I see it as an example of his obstinacy, where he's obstinately dug his heels in and refuses to move or accept what's going on. I can fix this, he thinks. You know, I can bring this back under my control. I can fix it. I can come up with a rational, reasonable solution, because that's what I do. I'm a man of science. I can put everything back in order and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is regardless of what insult or indignity is flung his way, he thinks he can get this back on course. We as readers see kind of a clear example of this about midway through Calypso, where the mail has been delivered after he returns home from pork butcher, and there's a letter from Molly written in bold hand to Mrs. Marion Bloom.
Mm.
He knows it's from Boylan. He sees the insults, the subtle passive insult in the way it's addressed, but then walks it upstairs, hand delivers it to Molly, who quickly stuffs it beneath her pillow and reads it at her leisure while Bloom is downstairs making her an orderly just-so breakfast. Because it's better to just let it happen than to admit the truth.
Mm.
Do you find that obstinate?
Could be. Yeah.
You're less.
It's a negative obstinacy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, diagnosis from me, not a doctor. Diagnosis is Bloom is very anal retentive.
Mm.
He's so fixated on butts. Just think, in this episode alone, he's been fixated on the moving hams on those immense melon fields north of Jaffa,
mm-hmm.
which a melon is a butt. When you see melons in Ulysses, guys, they're butts. And I've mentioned this quote from Ithaca. I finally actually wrote it down here. Can you read the quote from Ithaca where he describes Molly's butt as he kisses it?
He kissed the plump, mellow, yellow, smellow melons of her rump. On each plump melon's hemisphere, in their mellow yellow furrow, with obscure, prolonged, provocative melons, melonic.
Melon smellinus
osculation.
Yeah. He's so into butts, he comes home at 2 a.m. and he kisses his wife on her butt rather than, I guess, on her. I can't remember if he kisses her on her face, to be honest. Mm. But he definitely kisses her melanous, smellinous booty. And Bloom, we're talking about withholding poo is what makes you anally retentive. He literally withholds his poo in this final scene in Calypso, right? He eases into that morning poo in the Jakes with the thought, no great hurry, keep it a bit. I don't know about anybody else, but I think it's pretty common to just kind of get in there and get that job done.
You're an explosive personality.
I must be. Yeah. Some people go in there for like 40 minutes and like
I don't understand that. Yeah, like reading on the thrones.
I think
like,
they're anal retentive.
Get in, plop it, it's poison, get it out of you, wash your hands, get out.
Bloom, though, is like, I can literally be sitting in a smelly outhouse just like, I'm going to hold this. This outhouse can't tell me when to go poo.
It's like a cigarette break for them.
Yeah. He is explicitly thinking that he can hold his poo a bit as he sits there. So there's no question about that. And this scene comes right on the heels of Bloom recalling how Molly met Boylan, and just before that, Millie's letter about Bannon and kind of Boylan. So these are the things that makes him feel a lack of control.
Mm-hmm.
So his coping mechanism then is holding in his poo.
Mm-hmm.
He can control is the flow of his poo. He can't keep Millie or Molly at bay, which he knows. Remember, we're talking about how he's thinking, like, maybe I could go to Mullingar. Maybe I can stop her. No, I can't. He knows he can't. He keeps in his own poo just a little bit before giving in. So read this bit one more time.
Quietly he read, restraining himself, the first column. And, yielding but resisting, he allowed his bowels to ease themselves quietly as he read, reading still patiently. That slight constipation of yesterday quite gone. Hope it's not too big. Bring on piles again. No, just right. So, cost of one tabloid of Cascara Sagrada.
Bloom describes his defecation here with the same sort of delicate, precise language he uses to consider various businesses in his neighborhood, different ways to make money, things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's thinking about very precisely navigating that poo out of his beehole. That's what he's doing here. He is, though. Like, he's not just like, all right, you know, blast off. He's kind of like, just slide it down ever so gently, ease it out. And then when he's ready, he lets it fall.
Mm.
Joyce here does a masterful job as well of folding in Bloom's assessment of the titbit story into his assessment of his own regularity. This description is consciously about titbits, while it's subconsciously all about poo, orderly and obstinate. And so, could you read here? I took out the bits where he's directly talking about titbits. I'd like you to read this again.
It did not move or touch him, but it was something quick and neat. He read on, seated calm above his own rising smell. Neat, certainly. Begins and ends morally.
So is that about titbits or is that about shit bits?
It's shit bits, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just so well done. It did not move or touch him, right? So he's really like, it's coming out and it's not like,
it didn't cling to him.
Yes. Scraping up against... Yeah, you get it.
Yeah.
It was something quick and neat, but that could also be Philip Beaufort's story.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It didn't really move his heart, but, you know, it was a neat, quick little story. He read on, seated calm above his own rising smell. Neat, certainly. He's kind of patting himself on his back for being such a neat moral pooper.
Mm.
Begins and ends morally. That, I think, is also very telling. Mm. The way in which he's pooping, he considers to be moral.
Right.
Sure, he's talking about the story, but is he just talking about the story? Orderly, parsimonious, maybe a bit stubborn. And as I said earlier, in the blog post version of this topic, I go into what Bloom's anal fixation tells us about his sexuality, but that's a tale for another time.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think Ezra Pound was right?
Oh, that...
That Joyce should obscure this passage a bit to clean up the the story for the readers?
Of course not. No, because then it would ruin all the fun.
Do you want to elaborate?
But all the subtext and mm-hmm. yeah, the double meanings and everything would be obliterated. Yeah, mm-hmm. It would just be a guy reading a cheesy magazine.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point of that? Yeah,
you heard it here first, folks. Dermot thinks it's better with the poop scene. And on that note, do you want to say anything else? Because otherwise, I'm going to wrap up the episode.
Your time is up.
Okay. On that note, we'll see you at our next appointment in 2 weeks.
See you then.
Where we will, start Lotus Eaters. And the next episode up is going to be about Irish Orientalism.
Hooray.
So much fun talking about Orientalism a few episodes back. We're going to talk about the Irish twist on Orientalism, which will inform our reading of Lotus Eaters. All right. Until then.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of three things to help support us. Number one, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. Two, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And three, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group, Blooms and Barnacles Podcast, on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.